You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 406 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you again in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. I loved your awkward pause when you said where you were coming from. I know that we've both been traveling lately, but still in Seattle, Washington. Also, though, have to say, ironically, it's the Quandre Diggs edition of the Pelton Cast.
Well, in many ways. It's a tough one. Tough one for our guy. Honestly, for a second there, I was about to say from Boulevard Park, Washington.
There we go.
You can take a guy out of Boulevard Park, but you can't take them.
Let's go. Okay. I was in Mohai this last week.
No, I'm telling my story first.
You tell your story first, and then I'll get to my story. Just say Boulevard Park, and then we're just going to be going on.
My Lyft driver to the airport on Thursday, as I was going to Boston.
Oh, I actually wanted to hear about this.
Yeah. Says that he and his wife live in Crown Heights, not far from me in West Seattle. And he's like, yeah, she grew up around here, but I grew up 3 miles to the west. And I started to do the math in my head there. And I'm like, I think I know what's 3 miles to the west. And it turns out he grew up, no exaggeration, 3 blocks away from us, went to high school with both of our parents, was 2 years behind them at Glacier High School.
The driver was like pretty old.
Well, you can do the math on that one. I think you know how old mom is. He's about 70.
Holy shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Where exactly? I want to get into this granularly.
100...
Look, this is a podcast just for you and me.
Oh, no.
From Boulevard Park, Washington. So I want sights and sounds that only you and I would know.
It is really disappointing. We have the Italian Picnic listener. We have the Fairwood listener. We definitely have the West Seattle listener who commented on that. They live even closer to the GH pizza and pasta that I posted on Instagram the other night than I do. And I already live pretty close. But we do not have the Boulevard Park listener that I know of.
It would be offensive if we had one. We have to be the Boulevard Park listener. Okay,
true.
But yeah.
He grew up on 112th, and we were on 103rd and 14th.
Okay, let me pull this up. Hold on.
You're going to have to consult Google Maps on this one.
112th?
112th.
Oh, okay, 100. Oh, wow, that's really close.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
South 100th Street and 12th Avenue South. They call it Highline. How offensive.
They're not the listener.
Yeah, clearly. Interesting. Beverly Park Elementary School. Wow, that's pretty close.
I agree.
Well, and what road did Dad grow up on? Oh, I've like driven by this house. Oh, it's one of these houses.
It's a tremendous podcast.
Hey, I told you we're getting good. Look, you mentioned Boulevard Park. We're getting into it.
You know, we're going to make you wait till Friday for this podcast. And then we're going to give you just us chatting about locations in Boulevard Park, Washington. I didn't bring up the Dominic's.
This is over like kind of closer to Grandma Pelton's, though.
What's the other side of where it's not far from
where you remember we were driving to go look at the Christmas lights and there's the person getting like jumped or whatever on Christmas night. I want to say that was 1998,
that sounds
something like
right.
that. Yeah. And Bob drove way too close to the person as there was some sort of like gang fight happening in Boulevard Park on Christmas night.
I haven't said this to the group, by the way. I drove past the site where the house where our grandmother grew up on Queen Anne. Where you famously once fell backwards off the roof,
of course,
of the garage.
I've driven through there a million times. I've told everybody there's a house there.
Yeah, it's wild.
48 Aloha. No, it's bonkers. It's wild to see.
All right, what was your story?
A real piece of history gone. I was at Mohai this last weekend, my favorite museum. Everything about Mohai is just about how great Jeff Bezos is. Literally, you walk from room to room and it's like innovators like Jeff Bezos. And another room, it's like Seattle being propped up by Jeff Bezos. And then,
oh boy, is Jeff Bezos donating a lot to Mohai?
Reopened in 2012. And as we're walking out, this is not the story. As we're walking out, they have the donors and it's like 10 million plus Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
That one checks out. Wait, hold on. I have an aside to your aside.
Okay, let's hear it.
Did you see you? I guess you haven't been on Discord for a while.
No, I haven't.
Third Pelton brother Noah Cohen posted on Discord. There's an almost live Instagram account that is running a search. They're doing a search for a vote, but a search for Seattle's best almost live sketch.
Okay.
Which is a great idea. I can't believe we missed out on this one.
Well, that's
but the person who runs it,
but yes,
like curates collections for Mohai.
I mean, that makes so much sense. I love Mohai. It's my favorite museum.
I feel like we need to somehow figure out a connection here.
They have the championship trophy.
I think
you're
a
just
lot
walking
more than
along
that.
And it's kind of hidden away. You're just like, oh, there's the Seattle championship trophy. The only championship in the city of Seattle in men's sports for a very long time.
Between 1917 and 2013?
Yes. I mean, even if you include women's sports, it still was a pretty long time.
I mean, it only brings it down to 2004, yes.
That's pretty awesome. Like, you just, there's so many things where I'm like, that's not a like recreation of the Rainier R. That's the Rainier R.
They have the Rainier R?
I'm pretty sure that is, they have the Rainier R, and the one that's back up is a new Rainier R.
Yeah,
not the original.
It's definitely a new R. Yeah.
But it's dope as hell. Anyway, there, have you ever been to Mohai before?
Not in a long time.
I'll tell you, it is one of the only places to make the Great Seattle Fire very fun. But
you heard that you told us the underground tour did not make it fun.
No, we had to go there to cleanse myself. I was like, I wish they would have another Great Seattle Fire underground Seattle. Anyway,
I don't want that. Shouts to who's the guy who operates the tours? Bill something?
Bill, he's dead. Bill Swirsky's super fans.
Oh no,
no. Yeah, Bill Swire or whatever is definitely dead. So that's fine. Anyway, they have a map, an interactive map with every neighborhood in Seattle. And you could put notes about them or whatever. And so Riverton Boulevard Park, I'm like, just put a note in there. And it was like, you put your name and a note about it. And my name was Pelton Cast. And I put Home of the Pelton Cast on Riverton Boulevard Park.
I love it. Love it.
That was, I literally saw that. I did look for Cascade Fairwood, but first and foremost, it is like fucking salmon back to where they were born. I'm going to Boulevard Park more than anything.
Do they have an event space at Mohai? Like if bars fall through, could we do a live pod at
I'm
Mohai?
I'm sure it'd be so obscenely expensive.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah. Do we have a date for the live pod yet?
No response from the venue.
Okay. Well,
I'm working on it.
We're currently saving April 20th, not April 19th, which actually is better. I didn't realize April 19th is still the last day of the play-in tournament. That could be Lakers-Warriors for a playoff spot for all we know. So April 20th is what we're currently saving. Well, this is not an entire pod about Boulevard Park, alas. So let's start off with our toasts. We begin, as you alluded to at the beginning here, a farewell to Quandre Diggs, Will Dissly, and Jamal Adams, who were waived by the Seahawks on Tuesday, as well as Brian Monet on Wednesday. Moves that give the Seahawks $33-plus million in effective cap space, but say farewell to some of the longest-tenured Seahawks players. Quandre Diggs started all 67 games the past four seasons, made three Pro Bowls in Seattle, and I think still performed at a pretty high level last year. It's just the salary was too high given the nature of the spending at free safety. Right now, we see a number of safeties around the league being released. And the other thing, I think, you know, I think there was the Seahawks were probably going to make these moves regardless, but with a new coach and a defensive minded coach coming in, I think it made it that much easier to kind of make this change at safety.
I mean, it wasn't just the Seahawks, but like, this was a league-wide change in investment and safety. And
yeah, Jordan Poyer with the Bills, a number of others.
Justin Simmons. But like the money that they were spending on safeties, literally, you look at it at where – are we just talking this now?
Yeah.
Or are we saving it? Okay. Where the Seahawks had chosen to allocate their resources, because in the sport of football, you have a finite amount of resources because of the salary cap. And where they had chosen to allocate their resources spread throughout the team made almost no sense when you looked at it. And especially with it being so heavily weighted towards safety, a position that we're seeing a huge trend toward being much cheaper, it was it was inevitable that I don't know what I picked as far as percentage chances. I thought they would keep one of the two.
Yeah, it was much too high is the answer. You were 50-50 on Jamal Adams and 40% on Quandre Diggs. Ben was 85% on Quandre Diggs, 20% on Jamal Adams. I was 1% on Jamal Adams, 20% on Quandre Diggs.
Wow, just showing off, aren't you?
Now, of course, if they re-sign with the Seahawks, something that John Schneider said the door's not closed to.
It's not going to happen. Like
I think it may happen with the two other guys. I don't think it's happening with the safeties.
But the reality is they'd gotten themselves into a mess. So I was thinking about this, and I know we've talked about this before, but with this release, everything that has happened with Jamal Adams, both the trade, on-field play, etc., process-wise, obviously, outcome-wise, the Russell Wilson trade was worse. I think process-wise, this had to be the worst trade in NFL history.
I don't know if it was the worst trade in NFL history. Now it's interesting because, like, process-wise, the Herschel Walker trade is what everyone remembers. And that one was a little bit more complex. Like, basically, the Cowboys were playing chess and the Vikings were playing checkers on that one. Because all of these, as I understand it, like, a lot of the draft picks that Minnesota ended up sending Dallas were, like, conditional. Like, if you cut this player, you get the draft pick. If you don't, you know, if you keep the player, you get nothing. And the Vikings were like operating old NFL model, and the Cowboys were like ruthless new NFL model and cut all these players and got the draft picks. But still, I think there's got to be a worse one.
Okay, I'm going to say it's number two, because that one did end up being first and second round picks in 90, 91, and 92.
Yeah. I mean, the Cowboys dynasty was built off that one trade. Like, we could talk about all the other moves they've, you know, Jimmy Johnson and whatever, like, that trade built the Cowboys dynasty.
And it was for a running back. But, like,
also, if we're going to talk about a running back, the Saints trading an entire draft for Ricky Williams. Although, I guess, I don't know if there was a second first-round pick in that trade, but there might have been.
I still think that's a better trade than the Jamal Adams trade. Because the Seahawks traded...
No, it's a good trade. Because, you know, it was a COVID year.
Because it led to outcome-wise. Okay.
Have you not seen this?
What?
Is this new to you? Because, you know, it was a COVID year. We were picking 20-whatever, and in order to go from wherever we're at 20 to get up to a pick, a guy like Jamal, who was picked in the top five, you got to give up another first-round pick the next year. He came in here. Our coaches did a great job with him. He had 9.5 sacks, goes to the Pro Bowl, completely disruptive, comes back the next year. He's having a good season, gets hurt. Then he gets hurt, a really, really bad injury. I feel bad for him. Now, are there things we would have liked to have handled differently with him? Yes. Are there things I'm not sure he would have liked to have handled differently? Absolutely. But yeah, that narrative is not cool. Granted, that last line probably relates to the original question he was asked on Seattle Sports, which is about Jamal Adams got paid and then he just shuts it down and he wasn't this and that, which I agree is a ridiculous take. Jamal Adams legitimately.
Oh, I think Jamal Adams is trying to play. I don't think Jamal Adams is trying to play. Football players want to play.
Yeah. Also, it's not like he got the one contract and, like, there's no more money. You can continue to get more contracts if you play at a high level. Adams did not want to get injured. That's a ridiculous.
That part of it is ridiculous.
That's
an offensive line of questioning.
Absolutely.
And that's player blaming. The person who fucked up is John Schneider.
And
not Jamal Adams.
And then
Jamal Adams did nothing wrong. Well,
Jamal Adams did some things wrong, but not
the field,
with the trade.
Jamal Adams did nothing wrong.
TBD on that one too. But
okay, Jamal Adams also did some things wrong. But John Schneider, for the trade itself and the extension, this is all John Schneider's fault.
I think Pete Carroll was involved, but...
We can scapegoat Pete Carroll or not, but ultimately, like...
But yeah,
Schneider's the one who's making the moves here.
Look, the logic of the... And Third Pelton brother, Mike Sean Dugar, was talking about this on Twitter earlier this week. Like, the idea that, no, all the bad moves were Pete. All the good moves were John Schneider. Like, that's laughably naive. Ben Baldwin tweeted about this, of course, and someone replied, instead, you would rather he say, yeah, we sure screwed that one up. And, like, not exactly those terms, because you don't want a player blame, but this sport is so obsessed with accountability, like, admitting you made a mistake and that you can learn from it is how you avoid making the mistakes again.
Yeah. I mean, I don't.
That's why you need to admit that you made a mistake with your percentage chances of Jamal Adams and Quandre Diggs return.
I'll make that same mistake again. Don't worry. Oh. I will learn nothing. I think he probably should have been like, you know, here's what we thought going in. Here's what ended up happening. It was an unfortunate situation that happened. We're going to learn from it and move on. Done.
I mean, this idea that like the draft was different because of the COVID restrictions, like y'all ain't that good at drafting normally. So why would you think that having less information was going to make you worse at drafting? That information is what usually makes you make wrong picks.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, that's
the information
thing.
Made you draft Rashad Penny in the first round.
The assigning any sort of ability to personally to judge something that is almost impossible to judge, and that's really what this conversation is about, what happened in this draft is, or in this these transactions, is the Seahawks took the eventual step in moving resources from the wrong places to the right places. And for the most part, the last two drafts, since it seems like Jody Allen stepped in a little bit, for the most part, they have done a pretty good job at drafting for positions of need and positions of value. And the players that you see being extended in this time period, getting those second contracts, are players at the positions that the Seahawks drafted with at least their first round draft picks in the last 2 years. So have they made some mistakes in the second round? Of course they have. When viewed as a whole,
I think the idea that you were just going to stop there. Of course they have.
When viewed as a whole, I think that they have done a better job. And what this shows us is those players are going to be extraordinarily expensive. So you need to try to find those players on the cheap rookie contracts to go find tackles and receivers, obviously quarterbacks, cornerbacks, edge rushers, players like that. Go find those players in the early rounds of the draft. Use a shit ton of picks in the late rounds of the draft on every other position, linebackers, safeties, tight ends, all of that stuff. Go use those later picks on that. Go get a ton of later picks. Get a bunch of those guys. Find the players who are good. Let them walk. That's what you have to do. That is how you have to build a team, or wait for them to be released for another team and then sign somebody on a low value deal, a 1 year deal or something like that. This is the only way to build a roster.
Or trade a late round pick for Quandre Diggs, you know, when he's under contract for a couple of years. Like, that was a great trade and one that I don't think the Seahawks necessarily get enough credit for when they went out and got Diggs in the first place.
It was a fine trade. A lot of teams have made trades like that. I had a question about this, though. Have the Seahawks ever had a truly great pass rusher, edge rusher, in the history of the team?
Michael Sinclair? Who holds the Seahawks franchise record for sacks in a season? That's a good bit of trivia there that I don't know. Maybe Chad Brown when he was first signed?
Especially over like a long period of time. Because didn't Michael Sinclair have like 1 year where he was really good?
Oh, Jacob Green back in the 80s. He's before our time. Like 1992 is really the first Seahawks season I remember at all. Jacob Green qualifies. Sinclair is second in career sacks with 73 and a half.
I was thinking about, like, if you looked at the all-time Seahawks, edge rush has definitely been a position that they haven't ever had anybody like truly elite.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Anyway, that's why you spend those picks, because of situations like this. And they fucked up on those two players and those two contracts. They didn't fuck up with the acquisition of Diggs, but the extension was wrong. And the trade for...
I think the extension was actually fine. Where they messed up was making a bunch of his 2023 salary, converting that into a signing bonus so that his dead cap this year was going to be much higher. They were in fine shape. It was the needing to spend a lot of money elsewhere last year and putting so many resources towards last year. And now they're... Like, they did that same thing with Jamal Adams, knowing there was a very good chance that they would end up releasing Jamal Adams after the season. And now they're having to, you know, swallow that much more this year because of it.
So what is the dead cap going to look like for next year?
For 2025 or for 2024?
Well, isn't it going to hit in 25?
No. It all hits in 24. So Jamal Adams was not designated as a post-June 1st release. as was originally erroneously reported. So it's all coming this year.
What is the, I guess we could talk about Will Disley as well and Brian Monet, but like, I love Will Disley, obviously, but this was just a move that needed to happen. And
yeah, I mean, look, this was when we looked at his contract when it was first signed, and we're looking at like the outs to get out of it, which is not a great sign for a contract. Obviously, loved having Will Disley on the roster, and he again, I think it is realistic, could return on a smaller deal. So
I think it's unlikely, but I wouldn't be shocked. But yeah, I don't know. Okay, so what does their cap situation look like for this offseason after those moves? They have $44 million in cap space.
But when you account for their draft class and the needing to fill out the roster, that's when you get that effective cap space that over the cap calculates as 33 plus million. So it's a good amount of cap space.
Next year, they will be completely off. There'll be no money from Jamal Adams, no money from Quandre Diggs.
Correct.
When they hit the 2025 season.
Correct.
I mean, honestly, not Which a terrible place to be.
The right decision to make. Yeah.
When they also have Julian Love, it's not like they don't have a safety left.
Yep.
I.
As opposed to tight end, where they literally do not have a player under a veteran contract.
I kind of think they're in a fine place. I mean, we'll see what they end up doing with Leonard Williams or somebody like that. And there are many players that need to be added to the roster, but I think the defense in particular, they're going to have to go out and try to, you know, have that money go a long way. And it's probably going to be a bit of a rebuilding year for the defense anyway, but they still have, assuming Geno comes back, plus the two or three receivers, like the offense, I imagine that there shouldn't be too huge of a drop off, if any.
Yeah. As long as Geno Smith plays well and the Ryan Grubb as offensive coordinator goes well, like, yeah, the talent will not be appreciably different offensively.
So
the Seahawks are 13th in effective cap space.
I think that's fine to be 13th in effective cap space.
They are also
with the
currently
roster that they have.
Since Russell Wilson has not yet hit the Bucs, number one in the NFL in dead money.
The Seahawks are?
Yeah.
But it's because of the Russell Wilson trade that they were able to do stuff like this.
Absolutely.
Because of the talent that they got influxed from that and being able to add players like Devin Witherspoon and like Charles Cross. And you look at the offense, I don't think these releases do not make me change my perspective about the 2024 Seahawks almost at all.
Agree.
So I don't know. I loved Quandre Diggs. Jamal Adams was a very exciting player for a small handful of games. And I think that Jamal Adams, when he was playing at his peak, was a difference making safety. I think the Seahawks never really figured out how to play him, and he ended up getting hurt a lot, and that shit happens.
But it also might be more likely if you're undersized safety who needs to play as physically as Jamal Adams did. So that, I think that's also part of the lesson. Like, from Jamal Adams' standpoint, the injuries are really horrible luck and unfortunate. From the Seahawks' standpoint, there's a little bit of you should have seen this coming.
And they should have still been allocating their resources better anyway. Like, even if Jamal Adams, the chances of Jamal Adams exceeding the value of his contract, his performance exceeding the value of his contract, was almost impossible. So,
unless he played edge rusher full time.
Yeah. But he's not an edge rusher. Like, he could have played edge rusher full time, but that would have also been a schematic issue.
Yes. I agree. Will Disley is an example of, like, people do think injuries are more predictable than they are. He had those two season ending injuries his first 2 years in the NFL. Since then, played 62 of a possible 67 games over his last four seasons in Seattle. Scored a touchdown in his final Seahawks game.
It's so funny because I remember in my head, Will Disley has been injured for all these games. And I think he just was like mostly kind of not that effective.
He's blocking. I mean, I think he's good at what he does. What he does isn't as valuable as what the Seahawks paid him, which again goes to the allocation issue. It's fun to think Will Disley. I remember we talked about him on the emergency pod, and it was an emergency pod. It was the weekly pod. He had signed with UW as a defensive end.
That's so wild.
The day of the Seahawks Super Bowl parade. That's how long Will Disley has been part of our lives.
That's awesome.
Brian Monet missed all of last year. He had an ACL tear in December 2022. Hopefully we'll be back on the field this year. But again, not a position that teams invest a lot in, run stuffing, defensive tackle, a position that is kind of important to fill for the Seahawks. Another case where it wouldn't be shocking to see him back on a smaller deal.
They'll be able to fill that.
Are you getting back to our toasts? Congrats to Lauren Jackson and the Storm's Mercedes Russell for leading the Southside Flyers to the WNBL Grand Final.
Go.
Jackson had 38 points, 11 rebounds in Southside's deciding Game 3 win. It was a derby match against the Melbourne Blue Boomers, and Russell had 17 and 9 plus 4 assists as they advanced to face the Perth Lynx in the finals. Congrats to Isaiah Thomas, who's signing with the G League Salt Lake City Stars, where he'll play for Steve Wojciechowski. They learned in doing the research that Steve Wojciechowski is a G League coach now. He was the longtime Duke assistant who was at Marquette previously.
I remember that was you telling me who he was. I was looking at the Seahawks. I was looking through the Seahawks contracts.
Okay. A toast to Keon Brooks Jr. for gifting $25 Chipotle gift cards to ushers at Heckhead before last Saturday's senior day. Outstanding move here from Keon Brooks.
Oh yeah, dope as hell. I love Keon Brooks. I actually, it was funny, I was thinking about this because I was like, I'm not gonna have a coach's corner, I don't think, this week, but I was like, I should probably get like a Amazon gift card for the referees that have refereed every game because they've seen some things. And I was like, I should probably do that. And then I saw Keon Brooks do this, and I was like, oh, hey, I'm definitely doing that or nice. Whatever.
I am curious.
Chipotle's
like
how... kind. Everybody loves Chipotle.
Yeah, who can't?
I was gonna do that? Amazon. Why fund fucking Amazon? Look, they're good. I've been at Mohai. They're.
You give them a Mohai gift card. I'm kind of fascinated how Keon Brooks Jr. is going to get remembered. He had these, you know, this season in particular, really terrific year. 2 years at UW. No team success to speak of during it in terms of the postseason. It kind of reminds me a little. He's a higher level player than this. I think he's, with his 3-point ability, his improvement that he's made from beyond the arc this year, I think he's going to, at the very least, be a G League guy next year, maybe a two-way in the NBA. Like, it reminds me a little Will Perkins, my first 2 years at UW at the end of
he's
the
just
Bob Bender
gonna, he's
era.
Going to be a guy. You can just feel it. It's going to be a name that we will remember.
Oh, yeah, I remember that guy.
You said Will Perkins, and I was like,
I believe also number one, if I recall correctly, Will Perkins, much like Keon Brooks Jr.
There's so many players in Husky. I mean, you know, like NBA players like that.
Oh, no, NBA is different. Like, he played for the Huskies during a big period. You know, NBA is still playing professionally, right? He's still hooping over in England.
I saw that.
Will Perkins did also wear number one, so that is correct. All right, congrats to UW's Savia Sellers for making the Pac-12 All-Freshman team. She's the first Husky on the All-Freshman team since Harry McDonald in 2016-17. So that's a shocking amount of time to go without a member of the All-Freshman team. Congrats to UW infielder Jillian Celis, who was named Pac-12 Player of the Week after hitting .571 with 3 homers, 8 RBI during the Huskies' perfect weekend in Eugene. We'll discuss later in the pod. And lastly, this week, a farewell to former Mariners catcher Mike Zunino, who announced his retirement at age 32 on Wednesday. The Mariners' first-round pick played parts of 11 MLB seasons, including 6 with the Mariners, was subsequently an All-Star in 2021 for the Tampa Bay Rays when he hit a career-high 33 home runs. Zunino was waived by the Guardians in June after signing a 1-year contract with them. So a pretty abrupt transition from All-Star to out of baseball for him, alas. You have nothing to add there on that one?
I'm working.
Who is it?
The problem with sitting at my work computer, if an email comes in, I have to respond to it. I really expected a lot from Mike Zunino.
Oh, many people did.
Yeah, and he ended up being a pretty good player on the Rays.
His batting average was shockingly low. I did not realize how low his batting average was since, the Mike Zunino career manages to fit into my baseball dark ages. I maybe saw him play with the Guardians on opening day last year.
I feel like he wasn't in my dark ages. And I remember how low his batting average was.
Okay. Yeah, it was like 157 last year, I think. But even in his All-Star season, he hit like 211. So definitely not the strength of his game. It was all about the isolated slugging for him. Let's see, the work I want to do is to get in a toast to the Seahawks single season sack leader, if I can find it here on stackhead.com. It is, in fact, Michael Sinclair with 16 and a half in 1998.
There we go. 98.
Yeah.
Wow.
Jacob Green had 16 in 1983. Jeff Bryant had 14 and a half in 1984. Patrick Kearney had 14 and a half in 2007. And then Cortez had 14 in 1992, his defensive player of the year season.
It's really just been kind of a long time, I guess,
Yes.
to not have any one of those players in 17 years.
The
And
highest
even
sack
like 14's
totals.
a good number, but it's not like a wild number.
The highest sack total since then was Cliff Averill with 11 and a half in 2016, and Chris Clemens also had 11 and a half in 2012.
Yeah, like I think this was me chatting with Mateo about this, of course,
Oh,
who's seven.
I have a question for you, by the way. I
Yeah.
heard multiple stories in the past week about people explaining the concept of the 2-for-1 in basketball to their child of about this age. Have you explained that to Mateo?
Not at all, no.
Okay. Do you think he
I
knows what it is?
he's so much more knowledgeable about football
Yeah.
with regards to that. Like I feel like they just don't. They wouldn't sit around and watch basketball in the same way that they would sit around and watch football, or
Yeah.
like understand football strat basketball strategy. Well, maybe they shouldn't have moved the fucking team. You're all upset about it? It's not my fault.
I didn't want to move the team.
Okay.
Firmly against.
Blame your guy, David Stern. You're like,
But I'm not wearing
think
my.
they'd be watching a lot more basketball if it weren't for the Washington Huskies and David Stern. We're not going to go to Rainier Beach games that often.
So, in anticipation of our discussion later, I went back and listened to our podcast after the Huskies fired Lorenzo Romar, and I said I was no longer going to be a Husky fan. And you know what? It
Mission
took a while. I
accomplished.
think I
Yeah.
got there. I think
Oh
I
my
got there.
God. That was my exact thought. I turned on the end of the game against Wazoo, the Apple Cup of basketball earlier tonight, and I was just like, the Huskies are winning a game against a ranked team and it's Wazoo, and I feel nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just surprised you weren't disappointed.
I kind of was.
Cougs are gonna be fine. They don't.
Are they
They
in?
don't.
Are they a lock for the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, they're a top 25 team.
They were.
Now this does hurt their chances of getting to play because the first and second rounds are in Spokane this year, so it hurts their chances of getting to play in
Are they gonna, they're
Spokane.
not going to give Gonzaga a home game, are they?
I think they probably will. I don't know if they're allowed to, but.
What seed is Gonzaga right now? They're like on the, they'll
Oh no, I
be
guess
on
they. Oh
the
yeah, I guess they
lower
probably won't.
tier. It's only the top four seeds that usually get protected, right?
Well, Gonzaga's back in the rankings too. They were one spot either ahead or behind of Washington State. I believe they
Yeah,
were
I
19.
watched the game against St. Mary's.
You're familiar.
I was not happy about it.
Somehow
Just
the Huskies
watching
beat
those
both of those
games,
teams.
it is just like so bonkers how many white guys are on St. Mary's.
We're all Australian.
Anyway, yeah, my children don't watch that much basketball because, reasons. I feel like Seattle, we don't talk about that enough, just how devoid of competitive basketball outside of the storm
Yes.
the city of Seattle has had. Like, it is bleak. It's not even
Well,
like.
we're going to talk about it later in the pod.
Okay.
Not obviously in an NBA context, but
I
we're
have
going
not
to.
explained to a child the 2-for-1.
Right. Somebody was doing it in the airport when I was flying back from Boston. This brings us to our search for Seattle's best cookie, which took me this week to treat cookies in Burien. Treat is run by mother and daughter Monica and Chelsea. Began in May 2020, operating weekly at the Burien Farmers Market, where I came across them sometime in spring 2021. I couldn't pinpoint the exact date. They opened their brick and mortar in April 2021, and on that very first day, I ordered a dozen for all of us to share, including the famous cousin Katie and her husband Jan, etc. I like the cookie is maybe as good as any single cookie treat, and Hello Robin, as we talked about, amazing treat maybe came into this as my favorite to win the whole thing. How does that strike you?
I'm not surprised by it. I don't think they were my I think they kind of were they're like the cookie of record. But to me, I like treat cookies. It is just, they are so much.
It's true.
It is pure maximalism, right? Like the best things.
Think about when you order a box of four, expecting that you're going to be able to share it with your brother and bring him cookies while you record the podcast at his house. And then it turns out you
Sorry.
Don't.
Look, I would have eaten all those cookies.
It's still delicious on day two.
But it is, I'm trying to think of, like, I wish I had a great example of this. It's like a pop punk record or something, you know, maybe even just like a pop record where you're like, it's all sweet tooth. There's not the same level of depth and substance to it that I'm not saying it's not amazing treat cookies. That was why, like, I didn't need to try treat. I've had hundreds of treat cookies and it is a destination cookie shop to me, but I think it's going to be closer than you realize. And if you told me right now, the options are a Hello Robin cookie, a treat cookie, and a Chicorina cookie, I'm not confident which one I would pick out of those three.
That's why we're doing this search. And
so
we'll see what else ends up in contention.
I think the ones for me that are more interesting or maybe more likely to end up being the absolute winner are ones that are going to have just not quite as much of the, like, over the top, just sweet flavor profile.
Well, so that's part of why I wanted to go to treat as part of this process. And what I was hoping to bring it to you is I have not other than, I guess they had the chocolate chip, like, search last summer where they did like eight different styles. And I bought a box of those and also intended to share them with you.
Oh,
and you rejected them and sent me home with my plastic bag of melting cookies.
Well, weren't there nuts in like half of them?
Yeah, it wasn't ideal,
like,
for you.
Picking around through fucking walnuts.
All right, it's all fair. But I normally don't get the chocolate chip there. I normally, because they have rotating flavors month to month, and that's usually what I'm trying. So I wanted to try the Madison, which is their chocolate chip cookie with flaky sea salt. It still fucking hits. It's really good.
Oh, I'm sure it does. That's where I'm just like, I do need to go back and try it again. We could just put it in the bracket though.
I agree.
It's not like we don't need to talk about treat again. So, but can you give us some background on treat?
That gave you the background. That was it.
Okay.
I mean, I do think so. We've had smaller treat cookies when they make like seasonal tins or things like that. I do think the size does help them achieve. Like, the best treat cookies are the ones that really mound up in the middle. And that's a part that allows them, they're more stable, I would say, than the chocolate chip center cookies, like the cookie. Like, they don't necessarily fall apart, but they get very gooey on the inside. So I also this week had the Remy, which is another regular with soft peanut butter chip cookie dipped halfway in chocolate. And then among their monthly flavors, I had the Malia, which was meant to be a chocolate Helpia pie, a chocolate sugar cookie with chocolate coconut pudding filling, coconut whipped cream, and chocolate shavings. That's definitely a maximalist one. And then this might have been my favorite of all of them this week, the Ava, a churro, a cinnamon sugar churro cookie topped with dulce de leche, cream cheese frosting, and cinnamon sugar, which was pretty outstanding. All right, also this week, I tried some non-Seattle cookies.
Really?
Because, as mentioned, I was in Boston last weekend. So on Sunday, I brought back cookies from Flower Bakery and Cafe and Tot Bakery and Cafe. I don't know why I can't say that. In Boston, from Flour, the TCHO chocolate chip, which I think stands for three kinds of chocolate. And then I had the chunky Lolo with oats, chocolate, coconut, and toasted pecans. That was the one I thought I was going to like more because it was a bit thicker And the other one looked a little maybe dry, but then when I actually ate the chocolate chip, like there was a lot, again, that chocolate chip center that was quite outstanding.
All right.
And then I got a Linzer cookie with jam filling from a Tat Bakery and Cafe that was also quite good.
Nice. I had a cookie as well.
In LA?
Los Angeles, California.
City of Angels?
Yeah, I went to Yuko Kitchen Miracle Mile. It was a pretty nice little place across from the La Brea Tar Pits in that area. I
Oh,
don't know if you've ever been to Wilshire over there by
I have
LACMA.
not.
It's just don't go. There's no reason to go there. There's a music venue. There are a couple of offices. There's the tar pits. Nothing to see there. LACMA's great, I guess, but I ended up going over there looking for a place to have lunch and ended up at the Yuko place and saw that they had cookies. And they have, I didn't take a great picture of this, but they have a more chocolate chip cookies, which is just like, it's like the spines on like a porcupine, the amount of chocolate chips. It is chocolate chips everywhere. It was incredible. It was so sugary that I could only eat half, and also I was eating lunch too. I ate half and I carried that fucker around with me for an entire day. I had like a pouch on my hoodie and I had that half of my cookie with me just for like multiple destinations. I was going throughout LA with that cookie, but it was good enough. This is the sign that it was good enough that I kept it with me. I was not going to let it go because I was like, I'm going to eat that later. And you know where it took me?
Where did it take you?
I went to Nobu for the first time.
Wow, look
Have
at
you ever
you
been
on
there
the come
before?
up. No, I never have.
Yeah, Nobu by the beach. Can't believe this food is free. It was pretty good. It's kind of like there were some special dishes I felt like, but it wasn't. I literally was listening to that book about 11 Madison Park, and just like I am thinking about Nobu as if it's fine dining, and it's not really fine dining.
Okay, I have a an 11 Madison Park unreasonable hospitality story for you.
Do you?
So
I had another one too.
we're
But
at
wait,
din
no, I want to talk about Nobu first.
Okay.
But it was just like it was very, very good. And there were a couple of dishes that I think probably reached the level of exceptional. Honestly, the price was like I was almost underwhelmed with how expensive it was because I feel like people talk about
I
how
agree.
expensive Nobu is, but it wasn't like there was nothing, and maybe just my perspective about what is obscenely expensive is not the same as I don't it's probably the same as people in LA. But I was like, we're in Beverly Hills. It was fine. And the service wasn't over the top or anything. Everything about it was fine. And the food, I would say, was very good to maybe a couple of exceptional dishes.
That's not bad.
It was good to have gone, but I don't feel like, to me, it wouldn't be best. I think there's better sushi in Seattle.
That's plausibly true, I suppose.
I also had a salmon ravioli at an Italian restaurant. Also, I just ended up spending a lot of time in Beverly Hills. It was fucking weird. It was a weird trip. But I had a salmon ravioli in Beverly Hills that was top notch. I went to Erewhon for the first time ever.
Nice.
Yeah. Do you know what Erewhon is?
No.
Oh, Hailey Bieber smoothie hits. It's like the bougie like grocery store market.
I do think I've heard of this now that you
Yeah,
mention it.
you probably pronounce it Erahoon. No.
Would I overpronounce it or underpronounce it?
Just in
Unclear.
no, just incorrect. Also, you know what, Erewhon, also, like, people talk about how expensive the smoothies are. It's like $12. Like, it's expensive, I guess, but
All right, let me give you my hospitality thing. We're eating dinner on Saturday night. We were at Del Frisco's Steakhouse. Incredible buttered buns. I know one of your personal favorites,
oh
wet
yeah.
bread.
What bread?
And there's there's still like two of them left in the platter, and they don't even ask and just take them away.
They took them away?
Just took them away.
It was a negative hospitality
It
thing.
was a negative vibe, but then we asked for more and they did bring more out. So
No,
that
you
was
should
in that
not have had to
win.
ask for that.
I
To me,
agree.
I ugh, that drives me crazy.
Ebon Moss Bacharach would never.
You look at the different moments. I tell you this about the Kraken when I was at the Kraken game.
Yes.
About, I know I told you about the M&Ms, but
oh, there's another story.
Well, I was just thinking about pressure points that you have in situations when you're trying to treat people really, really well. Mm-hmm. And getting people to their seats. Did I talk about this though? Where there was like a family that showed up, and we were in very expensive seats. And there was a family that showed up, and there were people in their seats, and they had to have this confrontation with those people who were in their seats. And that to me is like a hospitality thing that if somebody is paying that much for seats at a hockey game, not because it's always awkward. There's never a moment when you're like, ooh, you're in our seats. Like it is,
ooh.
It's a really awkward experience to have somebody be in a place that you know you're right to be in, or to have to go find an usher or whatever. I don't know how to fix it, but I think that somebody should fix it. And I saw actually Steve Ballmer talk about the new Clippers arena, where he was like, if people are up and cheering, I want to give them something. And I was like, I think that you're thinking about this right, Steve Ballmer, that people, because to me at the Kraken game, the number one thing that I noticed was the amount of people that were in extraordinarily expensive seats. As a person who has been to two hockey games ever and watched like 12 hockey games ever with a small child who knows even less about hockey, the amount of people who are down there that don't know anything about hockey is extraordinarily high. And that is probably not the setup that you want. So figuring out ways to incentivize, I understand that there's a balance of fandom vis-a-vis, you're more likely, if you're going to every single game, to be in worse seats because you're paying more money on the gross amount, right?
You're in total.
If you have season tickets, you're more likely to have worse seats because you're not that likely to go to every single game if you have really expensive seats. I think there has to be a way to figure out that balance to have fans who are both knowledgeable and excited be closer to the arena, or at least like feel seen. And I think that's what Steve Ballmer was trying to do, was just like, if we have fans that are like hardcore fans, like we want to make sure that we're seeing them. So it also ends up with creepy fucking tracking. And that's the technology that Steve Ballmer was using. It was creepy tracking, and just be like, if fans are up and cheering throughout a game, I want to give them 20% off concessions or something like that. It's a complicated thing they're trying to figure out, but there is a hospitality way of solving professional sports.
I guess what my takeaway from your story is, it's weird that there's not like a better technology to help you understand when you're in the wrong seat in the year 2024, that it's still really just the fucking same as it was in 1974.
I'm not sure if, you pulled up on your phone instead of a hard ticket, but like,
there should be a better map associated with the ticket as opposed to just the seat and aisle numbers.
I think the people were intentionally in the wrong seats, though. I don't think they were surprised.
Okay.
That's the problem. But also at the same time, I don't want like
Mariners style, you can't go sit in any seat that is not your own.
Yeah. Because, and again, that's the other thing. I think pricing should be extraordinarily variable, if that makes sense. And this is actually a complaint I had about the Seahawks. Like, I'm looking at Husky baseball tickets for Saturday. It is supposed to rain. My children have determined they want to go to the Husky baseball game. That is like their number one goal. That's all they care about. How many people do you think are going to go to that Husky baseball game?
Probably not that many.
$12 a ticket, because it is a set price no matter what. And I'm like, it is $12 when it's sunny out, and it is $12 when it's rainy out. The demand is not the same for these two events. It should be like $1 to get people in there for this game, because they're going to make money off people once they're in the building. And even if they don't make money from people when they're in the building, they're going to make fans. They're going to build relationships. It is a good thing to have people in the building. If you do it for cheap for a while, and then all of a sudden people are like, it's always cheap, this is the argument against it, people will wait, they'll wait. But like, if enough people do that, all of a sudden that's not there anymore. And you have people who've become a fan of something and they're like, I need to do that. That's a thing I do. And it's now $15. Variable pricing should be way more variable. This is a problem that I have with the Mariners too. I was looking at Mariners ticket prices. You know, center field isn't $10 across the board this year.
Well, I do, because you've already complained about it to me.
It's fucking ridiculous that that's the case. But if you want to do variable pricing for center field, it should go down sometimes. It shouldn't just be 10 is the cheapest. Like there, I have been to games where there are hundreds of seats open, like basically not a soul in center field. There's a game against Oakland in the middle of the week.
Just because there's no one sitting in center field doesn't mean no one has bought seats in center field.
But there are times when people have not bought those seats. Like Mariners tickets should at the lowest end be like a dollar because getting you into the ballpark should be the goal. They're so concerned with this minimum value. It is the wrong way to approach it. Anyway, I'm fucking furious about it. And I mean, it's going to mean that I'm only going to Mariners games on like fucking Tuesdays or whatever.
If you'd like to hire Tristan to run your professional sports team, please.
The Mariners are doing it right.
@gmail.com.
This team has so little good faith. Like the goodwill that they have in the community, we could move to the Mariners section or whatever. That's where we're going to next, right?
It is, yes.
The Mariners have so little goodwill in the community after a year that they didn't make the playoffs, traded away many of the most likable players on the team, ended up with what we think is probably a better roster, maybe?
I mean...
And then they increased ticket prices. On the lowest tickets. Increase other ticket prices if you want, but why increase these tickets? It's fucking dumb. The Mariners are not a team I trust with understanding finances.
We heard from Kevin Mather, their CEO, many years ago. A lot of these 4 years ago, they told us a lot about who they are. Well, the Mariners should be reducing ticket prices for spring trading, where they got their second win of the spring on Wednesday, coming back to beat the Royals 9-8.
I wonder what those Burm tickets are.
And improving to 2-9. Good news after Tommy John fears because of tightness he felt during an early bullpen session. Matt Brash was clear to resume playing catch on Tuesday as part of his gradual ramp up. Fellow reliever Gregory Santos further along in that process. All right, Seattle Kraken update. Friday is the NHL trade deadline, and the Kraken traded center Alex Wenberg to the Rangers on Wednesday for a second round pick in 2024 and a conditional fourth round pick in 2025 coming from the Dallas Stars. That conditional pick could move up to the third round, but is unlikely to do so based on a previous trade. Kraken retained half of Wenberg's $5 million salary, which was a move that made sense in their situation. That trade leaves winger Jordan Eberle as the most prominent Kraken impending unrestricted free agent heading into the 24 hours before the deadline. At age 33, trading Eberle makes a lot of sense. Defenseman Justin Schultz, another 33-year-old, headed to unrestricted free agency. Kraken, 6 points or 3 wins out of the final playoff spot with 20 games to play. Like, people are getting all hyped up about the fact that they won back-to-back games this weekend in Canada. But that doesn't really materially change your playoff odds that much, I got to be honest. On last Thursday, Philip Grubauer recorded his first shutout of the season as the Kraken beat Pittsburgh 2-0. They then lost the finale of their homestand 2-1 to Edmonton before that back-to-back sweep north of the border, a 4-2 win over Calgary, 4-3-1 in Winnipeg. Wenberg did not play in either of those games awaiting the trade. And then Vince Dunn missed the second game after being boarded by Calgary's Martin Papasil, a hit that drew a 3-game league suspension. Kraken now back home to host Winnipeg on Friday to start a 5-game homestand that also includes the defending champion Golden Knights visiting on Tuesday.
Do you know about Rempe?
No.
For the Rangers? Oh, he's a fucking phenomenon. Like, important thing to happen to hockey in, like, I don't even know. Matt Rempe?
I didn't pick this up in the one Rangers game I watched during All-Star weekend.
He would have been playing then. He's just like a 21-year-old for the Rangers. Do you know where he played before this?
Seattle Thunderbirds?
Hartford Wolfpack. No, he played with the Thunderbirds for like a handful of back to like he played with them for like 3 seasons with the T-Birds. But he's just out there brawling in all these games, getting into fights and shit, hitting hard. It's dope as hell. It's like I remember seeing a thing where like people were like they had to take the fighting out of hockey, and I was like, for who? Like, I'm sure that there's a balance, but like when I went to the hockey game, I was like, every second I'm like, oh, they're about to fight. And Matt Rempe is like literally, I feel like he is up there with the most famous hockey players instantly.
It seems so. A lot of news stories. All right, Seattle Sounders. A 0-0 draw Saturday against Austin FC. With Raul Ruidíaz coming off the bench after battling a rib injury during training, they went back to the 4-2-3-1 traditional formation with Pedro de la Vega making his first start as a number 10 rather than the winger role he's expected to play when Albert Rusnak is healthy. The outshot Austin 23-2, but put just four shots on goal. Austin had but one. Ruidíaz played the last 30 minutes off the bench alongside Jordan Morris, had some of the best opportunities for the Sounders. Good news here, Andrew Thomas got his first career clean sheet in his second start in place of the injured Stefan Fry. The very bad news is that De La Vega now out 6 to 8 weeks due to a hamstring strain. Sounders designated players and hamstring strains, name a more iconic duo. Oh, wait. Without him, Sounders headed to Philadelphia on Saturday to take on the Union, who have drawn both MLS matches 2-2 at home versus Chicago, 1-1 at Sporting Kansas City. They're currently in action in the CONCACAF Champions League after reaching the semifinals last year. They beat Saprissa of Costa Rica 6-5 on aggregate in the opening round, scoring the tie-breaking goal in extra time. They lost last year's conference semifinals to Cincinnati. We learned last week that the Sounders will be among eight MLS teams to participate in the reformatted Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup. They'll enter in the round of 32. And Osvaldo Alonso was honored at Saturday's game after signing a ceremonial contract to retire as a member of the Sounders. So shouts once again to the Honey Badger. Seattle Reign FC will face the Thorns in Portland in their final preseason tune-up on Saturday. Next week, we'll have a Reign season preview as they begin the NWSL regular season. A lot of excitement for this NWSL regular season with games on ESPN this year. UW softball finished off the non-conference schedule with a sweep of doubleheaders against Maryland and Mount St. Mary's in the Jane Sanders Classic. They run-ruled the Terps in five in the opening game with Ruby Malin spinning a one-hitter before coming back from a 6-2 deficit, entering the bottom of the seventh of the second game, scoring six runs in the frame, capped by Olivia Johnson's walk-off grand slam. They then outscored Mount St. Mary's 23-3 over five innings apiece. Still slipped one spot in the rankings to number five, which was a little inexplicable. Huskies back home this weekend to host Arizona State as they start their final tour of the Pac-12. Sun Devils went 14-7 in non-conference play to rank sixth among the nine Pac-12 softball teams. UW women's basketball, a heartbreaker Wednesday against Arizona to open the Pac-12 tournament. They trailed 50-39 with 5:35 left, then went on an 11-2 run to get within two in the final minute. They had possession with a chance to tie or take the lead, but El Ladin missed a runner. Arizona made its free throws. 20 turnovers in this game, very costly for the Huskies and frustrating to watch. So despite the upset that they had pulled against Utah the previous weekend that we never got a chance to fully recap, Huskies firmly off the bubble now. And this will extend boring the men making a run through the Pac-12 tournament next weekend in Vegas. Only one Power 5 school has gone longer than UW without an NCAA tournament appearance by either its men's or women's basketball team. That one team is Vanderbilt, whose men last went in the 2017. Their women, once a power, went in 2014, but they're currently in the last four in. So Vanderbilt could break this streak and mean that nobody in the Power 5 has gone longer than UW without an NCAA tournament appearance. They are tied with Minnesota, whose men last went in 2019, women in 2018, and with Cal, whose men last went in 2016 and women in 2019, although the Cal women did move a step closer to ending that drought by crushing Washington State in the opening round of the Pac-12 tournament on Wednesday afternoon. I mean, despite the disappointment of the way the season ended, still a step forward for the Huskies in their second year under Tina Langley, easily their highest SRS in sportsreference.com's rating since their last NCAA tournament appearance in 2017. They lose Lauren Schwartz, so one of their starters, but everyone else is coming back. They add a pretty solid recruiting class. I think with the move into the Big Ten, which is also a very strong women's basketball conference, Huskies are going to be a trendy pick to return to the NCAA tournament in 2025. Just really adding a lot here.
Dynamite dropping.
That brings up.
I don't know why people keep fucking working.
It's 10 o'clock, people. If you answer the emails.
We're doing this slightly earlier than normal.
If you answer the emails, it's gonna encourage them to keep doing it.
They just keep responding.
You know, men's basketball. Let's start here. My former colleague Jeff Goodman of the Field of 68 reported on Twitter after Saturday's loss to USC that, quote, the quote, strong belief from multiple sources close to the situation is Washington will make a move with Mike Hopkins. Matt Norlander of CBS Sports echoed in his piece on the potential coaching vacancies. Some in the industry are operating as though this is unofficially official. UW is an interesting job in an evolving landscape. Some view it as a sleeping giant, considering the talent that annually comes out of Seattle.
Others view it not as that.
We don't view it as that. Well, one thing that will make the job more attractive if it comes open, the Huskies announced on Tuesday that ground will be broken on the long-awaited basketball-only practice facility this June with an anticipated completion in August 2025. It'll be located on the east side of Heck Ed, connect the ground floor of the building to the Performance Center in the Graves Annex, which is what we always walk by when we're walking out of Husky Stadium after games.
There we go. Oh.
We'll recognize it.
Oh, so we won't be able to walk through there anymore.
No, because the building is going on top of that. So I don't think it's going to change it.
Good. If I don't get to walk through the Graves Annex, I'm going to be furious. Look, they're not. This team is not a sleeping giant. That is like the level of talent. UW football, when UW football hired Steve Sarkisian, hired Chris Peterson, that was a program that was ready to be back on the national stage. They were able to hire coaches like that. UW basketball has not hired a coach like this. They hired Lorenzo Romar. I mean, there's only been two hires in the last, you know, two decades or whatever. They hired Lorenzo Romar, who is an ex-Husky.
There's only been two decade hires since 1993. There's only been three in three decades, right? Because Bob Bender was here like...
Where did Bob Bender come from? What was his background?
He was an assistant coach at Duke.
Okay. I mean, that might have been, back in those days, a pretty big hire.
But it wasn't like a Chris Peterson level of hire.
No, not even close. Or even Steve Sarkisian. Like, they are not attracting the kind of coaching attention that UW football has. And UW football is past sleeping giant. They're just an established national program now. But
look, number one, UW is a football school. Number two is a point we've discussed on this podcast. Conference matters a lot less in basketball than it does in football. So that's the amusing scenario, is that Jed Fish will go from Arizona to Washington in football and have it be seen as a step up. In men's basketball, Arizona is a top five job in the country, maybe top 10 at worst.
What is the money also? What does that look like between... It's quite a bit lower for basketball coaches.
It is considerably. Like, one of the coaches I was looking at who's considered to have too much money on their current extension to move is TJ Otzelberger at Iowa State, who was briefly for 1 year an assistant to Lorenzo Romar. Maybe 2 years.
I remember that name.
Yeah.
He's a good coach now. We fucked that one up too.
I mean, I don't know what they were supposed to do there exactly. I don't think the timing ever made sense. But Iowa State's a projected 2 seed in the NCAA tournament.
I was going to say, I saw that Iowa State's really good right now.
Yeah, he also might not leave. He was an assistant coach at Iowa State before coming
here.
He's
in the best basketball conference too, though. Like, this isn't college football. The Big 12 is a better basketball conference. It's the number one basketball conference and getting better next year.
And his wife, Allison Lacey, who was a member of the Storm Championship team in 2010, played at Iowa State. So they've got pretty strong ties to Ames.
Yeah, that's not happening. I just don't. Sleeping Giant is not. Wait, did you have multiple reasons?
The other reason was, so this one I thought was interesting. Norlander's piece also talked to Trilly Donovan, who is a college basketball newsbreaker on X, formerly known as Twitter. And one of the questions that he got from readers that he posed to Trilly Donovan was like, which schools have underrated NIL? And UW was on his list.
Underrated NIL?
Yeah. Which I think squares with what we saw in terms of the transfers who have come here the last couple of years, including
They've
two guys from Kentucky.
Bro's got Moses Wood money.
Paul McKay was a starter at
a power conference game. No, he was a good transfer. It just, I don't.
And, I mean, like, yeah, UW got It wasn't a bad team this year. They
got
what good
is wrong
trades.
with Mike Hopkins? Let me just ask that question. Like, it almost feel it's not personal, but it's like there's been too much talent on this team for them to have not been good under Mike Hopkins for a very, very long time. And
I mean,
is he
it's
just
weird.
Maybe not that good of a basketball coach? Or did the talent just never make sense altogether?
I think that's possible. I mean, it's interesting because of the fact that for many years, your criticism would have been, well, he's never put together even a decent offense. Coming into this year, the best the Huskies had ranked in adjusted offensive efficiency on KenPom in the Mike Hopkins era was 110th, which is basically like the worst Lorenzo Robar team other than his first year at UW. But this year, like the offense is 39th. The offense has been great, and the defense has not been nearly good enough. And since the Jaden McDaniels, Isaiah Stewart year, they have not been higher than 75th in adjusted
defensive
efficiency.
Do you think the zone has something to do with that? Like, is the zone?
I don't think the zone was good enough. I definitely don't think that.
But do you think
that
the zone
when it didn't have Matisse Thybulle in it,
the offense stats seem worse and the defense stats seem better, or
but the defense stats weren't seeming good.
They also weren't good. Like, if this team would have played zone this year, let's say it is exactly the same.
I mean, they did end up playing a fair amount of zone in conference play. They didn't play as much zone during the part of the year that you watched.
Yeah.
I don't know what Synergy Sports has them at for the season.
What Synergy Sports shows at the games that I watched.
Yeah, I mean, it just wasn't good enough. I don't know what to tell you. And this year, like, they were somewhat undersized. It makes sense. But, you know, in previous years, they
kind of
had...
like this team. Like,
I agree.
I'm sad that most of this team will be gone. I hope that Corin Johnson returns with whomever the new coach is. But
I guess they only have him at 12% zone for the season.
That's pretty low.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just wasn't good enough. That's it. They gave Mike Hopkins. I actually think it made sense to give Mike Hopkins this year in hindsight, because this team could have been an NCAA tournament team and it could have felt like he was building something, and he didn't. And when he is fired, inevitably, he will have had every possible opportunity.
I
It
mean,
won't feel like it was premature.
I know there are a lot of people that would have been unhappy if there would have been an NCAA tournament appearance and a possible extension for Mike Hopkins. I don't feel that strongly about the situation. But I do think that they certainly have the chance to upgrade with a coaching change.
Are we going to talk about possible replacements or wait for the Mike Hopkins to officially be fired?
Let's talk about it, because I don't know that we're going to get I don't know that we're going to do an emergency pod on this one.
Mike Hopkins doesn't even get an emergency pod.
We'll say. I mean, what it's basically, if it's unofficially official,
we
I
did
don't...
so many emergency pods back in January. We were just like, we're good. We're exhausted. I've got work emails to answer.
I don't know if the level of interest is quite as high. Yeah. So I would say since
the Seahawks are hiring like the seventh like secondary coach,
we
nepotism
even...
secondary coach. It's like, we're back with the Jack Del Rio's son emergency pod somehow.
You saw that Bill Belichick is coming to speak at the UW Coaches Clinic, right?
Is he really?
Oh yeah, I don't know how they got him.
That's awesome.
So if TJ Otzelberger is off the table, then I think the first call is to UW legend, Bellevue native, Mark Pope.
Okay. Head coach at
BYU.
Okay.
Currently enjoying one of the better years in program history. You wouldn't necessarily know it from their conference record, because they are in said Big 12 and they're 9-8, but 21-9 overall, 16th in KenPom. They were previously 13th in KenPom in 2019-20, his first season at the helm there. They had a couple of down years before this, but that's, and all the reporting kind of on the coaching market suggests that he may be interested in making a move after this season. So he coached at Utah Valley before that. He was replaced by Mark Madsen, who's now at Cal, and has had a pretty successful first season given the mess that he inherited at Cal.
I think this would be awesome.
First instinct.
Is there a reason that, I mean, do we think there's a reason that he wouldn't? I mean, played at UW, Successful well, coach.
The reason would be if he got a better job than UW. Like, Pope is going to be pretty high. Dusty May, I think, from Florida Atlantic is going to be the hottest mid-major name.
But you think Mark Pope is near the top of replacements?
Without question. And, you know, one of the things that always happens is some of this is dependent on how their teams do in the tournament. Like,
let
if BYU goes on a run.
The sleeping giant piece out there. If you were to argue the flip side of that, which it's a lot easier to argue. If you're arguing it when you're hiring Florida Atlantic's head coach coming to the University of Washington, it's a lot harder to argue. When you're arguing it to Mark Pope, who played at UW, that is an argument that can be made. Because
I don't know, though. He did decide to transfer from UW in the midst of, like, the dark ages of UW men's basketball.
To where?
Kentucky.
I don't begrudge him.
Who does?
But it's still, when you look at it from the perspective of, I think conferences matter a lot less in basketball, but they're still going to the Big Ten. You know what I mean? Like, they're financially, it'll be a better setup for UW basketball. I just don't know if national TV matters with regards to college basketball, but it must matter some. And both the financial piece, Troy Dannon is not looking to go cheap on this hire. I think Troy Dannon has been tasked as the AD after Jen Cohen coming in and after the move to the Big Ten to do the fucking thing. So I would be surprised if they got massively outbid for somebody like Mark Pope.
I mean, it's just like Louisville is out there. That's the first, you know, big opening. Well, I guess they're not technically opening that. Sorry. Ohio State is out there. Ohio State is also going to have a lot more money to spend to them. And then Louisville is all but certain to come open. So those are two schools that are clearly ahead of them in the pecking order. Stanford's going to be, in all likelihood, another team that is in a similar range, probably below UW financially. And you're going to the ACC.
Think about the travel that you have to do. Like, if you think UW's travel is bad, like, at least there are some other teams on the West Coast.
I mean, we should talk about it. So, like, you know, one of the things I've said is, you know, who's the hot up and coming guy on the West Coast is what you inevitably do in this.
Yeah.
Well, the answer is very simple. The guy who's most attractive on the West Coast, who's likely to live, is Kyle Smith. But like how he could do that to Washington State, how the UW Board of Regents could do that to Washington State at this point. Like, I know Marv Harshman went from Washington State to UW at one point. And then they named Heck Edmondson. It was one of them. I think it's Heck Edmondson started at Washington State, but that was like 100 years ago. Very long.
They're going to name Autzen Stadium Jabbar Muhammad Stadium. Jabbar Muhammad Field.
Even Marv Harshman coached there too. Oh no, I guess it is him. It is him. I'm thinking of not Heck Edmondson. It's not going to happen. He, I think, is going to go to Stanford. That is my expectation.
You think Kyle Smith's going to Stanford?
Yes.
Man, I just do not. I guess Stanford has like a pretty solid history, but.
Yeah. They have a really solid history.
And they will be playing against elite programs in the ACC.
So there's also a lot of good schools in the Mountain West.
We'll see.
Has often been the case. The Pac-12's complete void of power has been filled in the West Coast by a number of. I mean, the WCC has two strong teams. I don't think I'd be very surprised if Randy Bennett left St. Mary's. But the Mountain West has many strong candidates. The one who gets connected the most to UW is Danny Sprinkle at Utah State. He's in his first season there. Previously was at Montana State, where he took them to the NCAA tournament back-to-back years in 2022 and 2023. Utah State has been kind of a program that has launched a number of coaches to the major conference level in recent years. Craig Smith's now at Utah and has done a pretty solid job there the last few seasons. He was replaced by Ryan Odom, who went on last year to take the VCU job from Utah State. So Sprinkle's kind of the next guy up there. He was apparently born in Pullman, so that's his tie to the Northwest specifically, but has been on the West Coast recruiting in relatively the same area. I'd also throw out Nico Medved from Colorado State. not necessarily as much of an up and comer, but this will be their second NCAA tournament appearance in his time, and that's a school that only made the NCAA tournament, hadn't previously made the NCAA tournament since 2013 when he got hired in 2019. There's a couple of candidates. He's the most prominent candidate who beat UW this season, so that's a bit of a feather in his cap.
I feel like all these are seemingly good hires. I mean, they went and plucked Mike Hopkins kind of out of nowhere. It was a little bit of an out of left field pick. Troy Dannon with the Jed Fish hire made probably the most obvious hire that there was, as far as somebody who was literally like you just looked at the order of teams and who was next up. He went and found somebody who had an excellent season at a slightly smaller school and then paid them the money and had them come here. And knew that they had the infrastructure and the institution. I think from everything that Troy Dannon has done so far as UW athletic director, he's kind of done the obvious and right thing. So that's what I would anticipate for this.
But we have a pretty small sample size, and there's nothing as obvious as Jed Fish, is what I would tell you. So we'll see. So against that
How about this?
backdrop,
It's not just Jed Fish. It was he talked to Chris Kleiman, Lance Leipold, and Jed Fish. It was not
they
just
were the
he.
three guys at the top of our list. Yes.
Yes, he. It was here's who everybody thinks it's going to be. That's who he talked to, and he hired one of them. So, I would say there is a strong likelihood that the names that people are thinking from the outside is also going to be the names that are going to be considered on the inside.
But again, it's a sample size of one. So that's not a very big sample size.
Your mom's a
Again,
sample size of one.
broke that mold. They broke that mold. Against that backdrop, the Huskies won two of their last three games. They made 15 threes last Thursday against UCLA, their most in a game since December 2017 and most in a conference game since 2011. On Senior Day, USC took the lead for good with a 9-0 run late in the first half. Huskies did make things interesting, but couldn't get the stop they needed to ever get the ball back with a chance to tie. Braxton Mia went through senior day festivities despite having a year of eligibility remaining, although it's worth noting that Keon Brooks Jr. did that last year and decided to return. Frank Kepnong did not go through senior day festivities. We were wrong last week. He does have a year of eligibility remaining, regardless of whether he gets an injury redshirt for either of his last two seasons. And then Thursday, Huskies knocked off number 18, Washington State, as we talked about.
And Tristan felt nothing.
Notably, Corin Johnson got the start in this one over Sevier Wheeler, had a team high 23 points. Like, this is
Corin
college
Johnson's a dog.
basketball.
Corin Johnson's
So
dog.
we have no idea. Like, back in the day, you could be like so excited about, oh man, Corin
Well, there's
Johnson.
also, we know a coaching change is coming too, so it's a
Yes.
little different.
There's a lot going on here, but I sure hope Corin Johnson sticks around.
Don't get too
Very excited about
attached.
his
Don't get
future.
too attached to any of these players.
Not even Breidenbach?
Don't get attached to anybody. Wait, does
You
Breidenbach have more eligibility?
bet. I think he might
That
only
man's
have
16 years old somehow.
he only has 1 year left. But he does have a year remaining. Shouts to Breidenbach. Up next, the Pac-12 tournament for the Huskies. There is a wide variability in where they could finish in the Pac-12 and therefore who they could play. They will definitely be playing on Wednesday. We know that much, but they could finish as high as a tie for fifth in the conference, depending on
Wow.
how things play out. And they definitely will finish no lower than ninth. So somewhere between fifth and ninth.
What I don't want is a miraculous run to the NCAA tournament and things to get dicey.
That
There's an
would
amount
be.
of games that Mike Hopkins could win in a row. I'm not saying it's likely, but there is an amount of games that he could win in a row that would keep him his job.
I suppose if they had Oregon State's run in 2020, they
If
or
they make a Sweet
2021.
16, all of a sudden Mike Hopkins is probably your head coach next year.
I mean, don't know. I might take it. Like,
Would you?
when are they going to make a Sweet 16 again?
Yeah, but it's off a bunch of players who are almost certainly going to be gone,
Who
all
cares? They haven't
seniors.
done it in 14, 13 years.
All right, fine. Whatever. It's not going to happen. We don't even have to worry about it.
I don't think so.
It's like this is the only time that I actually love that college basketball gives you hope until the very last second. Like you kind of constantly have hope, except for in the Big Ten next year, where we probably only make the tournament, the conference tournament.
Yes.
But I like that that happens. And this one scenario is the scenario where, like, maybe less hope.
We should also mention here that our old friend Lorenzo Romar was let go at Pepperdine. So, although, I don't know, is he still coaching the team for the tournament? I'm not sure, but they had a huge win today.
I was going to say, I think they won by like 50 points. Lower was cooking.
Yeah, when the season ends. So he's still coaching through the West Coast Conference tournament and potentially beyond.
To win the championship, Lauro.
It would be great. This is a terrific headline. I don't know if the Huskies will borrow this. Men's basketball announces update to coaching staff. At the end of the current season, Lorenzo Romar will conclude his tenure as head coach of the Pepperdine men's basketball team after six seasons at the helm. So there you go. Mistakes were men. All right, UW football, happy news. Walk-on linebacker Drew Fowler was placed on scholarship. He led the team last year with 320 special team snaps for Pro Football Focus via On Motley. So well-deserved, certainly for Drew Fowler, who was also part of the rotation at linebacker. Less happy news. Last week, former UW running back Emeka Megwa filed a civil lawsuit against the UW and former members of the coaching staff and performing staff, alleging mistreatment under Kalen DeBoer's coaching staff of his return from an ACL tear, which resulted in a second ACL tear in 2022 and his eventual departure from the program. To refresh everyone's memory, and you know, since in mine as well, as I was doing this research, Megwa had suffered an ACL tear in June 2021 going into his senior year of high school. So he chose to reclassify, rehab the injury at UW under Jimmy Lake's coaching staff at that point. And that now, according to the lawsuit, in early January 2022, despite not having medical clearance to participate in team activities, UW coaches instructed Emeka to participate in a team run and lift. Emeka voiced concerns that much of his rehab was being skipped, putting him at risk of re-injuring his knee. UW staff reassured him that he was doing as well in his recovery and told him to practice. Later in January, Megwa reported pain in the same leg as his ACL tear, and the lawsuit alleges training staff opted not to consult with team physicians. Megwa then felt sharp pain in a lateral drill on February 1st. Per a lawsuit, the UW coaches repeatedly berated and ridiculed Emeka in front of the team because he could not fully participate in workouts or finish workouts because of his pain. And here is language directly from the lawsuit. They called him a pussy and yelled, "Drop your fucking nuts and get on the fucking line. That's some pussy ass shit." In March 2022, an MRI confirmed that Megwa had retorn the ACL and also suffered tears of the medial and lateral meniscus. The lawsuit alleges a UW coach, quote, told him to enter the transfer portal because he could not play. Megwa ended up walking on at Oklahoma, where he saw his first career college action during 2023, playing two games and getting one carry.
Yikes. I don't know. I still feel like the piece that gets lost pretty often is, and I think about this all the time in so many different situations, that these are human beings' lives, right? Like Chris Peterson, Kalen DeBoer can just move on. The team will move on. But ultimately, like, there's going to be other running backs. But for Emeka Megwa, this is his life that he's dealing with. And the magnitude on the team is not that great. But for him personally, this is everything. And so it's obviously unfortunate to hear that they, especially the pieces about not listening to him with regards to the injury. I mean, I hope that he wins this lawsuit.
I mean, look, we're also hearing his side of the lawsuit. Yeah. Obviously, there's another side from the UW staff, mm-hmm. and they deserve the right. We'll see. You know, I can't imagine this lawsuit would end up going to trial, but, you know, they deserve a chance to share their side of the story as well. But certainly troubling.
And I think this is probably not a situation that is exclusive to this Kalen DeBoer coaching staff. It's throughout football and sports in general.
Without question. All right, a little more Seahawks talk. After non-committal public comments, Jordan Schultz reported the Seahawks told Geno Smith he will be their quarterback in 2024. I mean, not surprising, but still interesting that they, you know, kind of slow played this as much as they did. Negotiations for free agency can begin on Monday. The new cap year and signings begin on Wednesday. Key free agents for the Seahawks, to refresh your memory here, Drew Locke, who John Schneider said they'd like to have back. Tight ends Noah Fant and Colby Parkinson. So as I mentioned earlier, basically the entire production at tight end last season with Will Dissly released. Guards Damian Lewis and Phil Haynes. Defensive tackle Leonard Williams, who Schneider again said would be a priority in his appearance on Seattle Sports on Thursday. Edge rusher Darrell Taylor. Linebackers Jordan Brooks and Bobby Wagner, another position where with I believe Devin Bush is also a free agent. The Seahawks basically have no one who saw meaningful action last year on under contract.
Said there was an 80% chance of Bobby Wagner coming back. I was looking for some places that I could make up some percentages. Bring back Bobby. Seahawks legend Bobby Wagner.
I mean, I would be happy to be wrong on that one, but
Yeah. All right.
we'll
Well, I'm
see.
happy for Gino. And I love Spicy Gino on Twitter as well. Just like interacting, talking about how great Gino is. It's pretty funny. I was like in my head, I was like, I'm just gonna start tweeting like a professional athlete and just like tweeting out some like random shit or whatever. Like I feel like Gino's so exceptionally good at that, where it like probably is like actually means nothing, but it's like something like kind of seems like it's pertaining to information that might be behind the scenes or whatever. And then like random self-promoting stuff. I think it's pretty funny.
Are you going to do that about the Pelton cast?
Yeah, no. Pelton Cast is off X, formerly known as Twitter.
Well, that's all I had.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
I
Very abrupt end to this one.